how it was. At the end of the age of oil.
Can a city really work without oil? How will we ever make the transition? I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and you are in for a treat. Peter Newman has designed public transport in Australia and studied sustainable cities all over the world. Now we'll hear his first speech of the book tour for Resilient Cities, Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change. The one-hour talk on January 9, 2009 was hosted by Anthony Pearl of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. In this speech, Peter Newman acknowledges the possibility of city crash, the Mad Max movie scenario as oil and the climate decline. Perhaps the rich will retire behind armed eco-friendly barracks. But Newman sees a better way out. I dared to hope after hearing him.
So the book is called Resilient Cities Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change. And we also have this other book that Tim wrote and which I helped him on, called Green Urbanism Down Under. We have a website, resilientcitiesbook.org, and there's a whole lot of extra material on that, including this PowerPoint. But peak oil, to me, has been a more important issue in the sense that it is dramatically happening and is changing our economy now. It is simply saying there is a practical limit to the number of barrels of crude oil that can be pumped every day. Now, that was on the front of the Wall Street Journal. But it's taken 30 years to get to the point where people will even talk about it. It's a simple geophysical fact that oil fields go through a production cycle and have a peak and they go down, and that every country, every region has a point where it goes through that cycle. The US peaked in 1970. It's now 87% depleted in its own oil supplies. I still talk as though if you do some magic tweaking, suddenly the oil will be found and, you know, they'll get back to being secure again, but constantly gone down. The man who predicted that was M. King Hubbert back in 1956. He could see the black swan. He was considered mad, as I'm sure people said about Fleming. He didn't have a photograph he could bring back, but he said they're black, those swans. And this is a phenomenon now that we've had to adjust to, and increasingly people accepting. But he predicted that world oil would peak about now, and the reality is discoveries of oil have been going down. These are the countries that have all peaked in oil. The amount of oil that's left is now a constant, ongoing, contentious issue, but increasingly people are coming to seeing that kind of shape. That's the basis of we've been looking at and saying, well, what does it mean for our cities? It basically means that this era of cheap oil is over. The latest reports, and these have come out since we finished the book, the UK one is a very significant report. The five mega major oil companies have all peaked, and that occurred in 2004. Now, they can go anywhere in the world to find their oil, but they're going down each year. This report says the key to peak oil is to understand that there will be extremely volatile prices, and yet the underlying trend is an increase in 6% a year in the price, and that the permanent decline, they say, would be after 2013. The CEPA index, which is about exploration and development, has doubled since 2005 because the rest of the oil is harder to get. This was the interesting one, though. The World Energy Outlook, every year, the IEA, who's the major international body looking at energy, they've essentially said peak oil, rubbish. Don't believe it. There's always more oil. It's just a question of economics. They're now very concerned. Output is declining faster than previously thought. I heard interviews with the author of this report trying desperately to cover up why it was they didn't say anything more about this before. Why did they suddenly change? And really, he couldn't explain it, but I'd say the political pressure was pretty much there. The annual rate of decline is predicted to be 9% a year. You imagine putting that into your own life. that you have to have 9% less oil use per year from here on. How would you manage? That's the way the world has to face. And we've got a whole lot of countries like China and India that aren't too keen on that idea. If we invested massively, we could make that 6% decline. We have to find a Saudi Arabia every 2 years. So there's this huge uncertainty. But what has happened in the economy is essentially that peak oil has happened. It doesn't matter when that actual physical peak occurs. It might not be for a couple of years, but it happened. And it happened in this past year. Essentially, the price rose quite dramatically, and it caused the car-dependent subprime mortgages to fold, and banks were loaning excessively based on the belief that car-based growth would always happen. So essentially, that rise in fuel tipped us over. Now, the link between peak oil and the crash is increasingly being made, but it to me is just very, very obvious that that's what happened. And where we now sit is that we have a lack of confidence in the future because of that rise. At some time it might happen again. Then what's it going to do? What's it going to do to our new suburbs? What's it going to do to our transport systems? There is a lack of confidence, and that undermines the economy. It's very hard for people to see their way through it. But there is also a lack of confidence in alternatives to that oil, because it dropped again. It dropped to a point where it's way below any kind of economic alternative. The Canadian tar sands, the biofuels and so on, they're so much harder to produce. And now suddenly they're off the agenda while the price is down. So it's a difficult future, and it's even more difficult for those people who living in those areas where the mortgages had to be caused the foreclosures. It's quite common to talk about toxic loans in this area, and less to talk about what I call toxic urban scatter. We've had urban sprawl and the issues to do with suburbs going further and further out, but the areas that were really vulnerable to increased prices were what I call urban scatter. These are areas that are beyond urban boundaries. And in the US cities around Houston and Atlanta and Phoenix, these areas are just places where there is no work, there are no services, there is certainly no public transport, and they are highly vulnerable to increasing fuel prices. So whole towns, whole suburbs have been boarded up. Now, that is a terrible thing to have happen to a city, and it's one that I just can't believe that we've got ourselves into that, and we really got to deal with it. We can't let that sort of thing happen. We have a situation of really serious angst. The oil-based economic confidence is undermined, and deservedly, and there is real fear. We have to recognise that fear, and the word resilience is really about how we overcome that. The declines are now being seen in all the data. 4% decline in vehicle miles travelled in the US in the last year. The first time a real decline has set in. But it actually started a bit before that. So there is a social trend as well as being related to fuel. But the costs of transport, when you get very high oil prices, when they come 60% of the cost of a container being transported is the transport fuel costs. When you get up to $150 a barrel, that means you really can't keep going. So how do we respond? This book is a positive book. It is recognising these issues, but it is trying to say there are things we can do. There are four options, as far as I can see. Only four: collapse, ruralised city, divided city, resilient city. Collapse is certainly on the agenda. If you go to the websites like lifeafterthecrash.com, dieoff.com, these are not pleasant reading. And even Oil Drum, which is much more scientific about peak oil, there are certainly a lot of people who see the future as very devastating, and that civilization as we know it will end soon, as a Republican congressman said. So collapse can happen and has. I mean, cities do collapse. Ephesus was abandoned in 1000 AD. It was the second biggest city in the Roman Empire. It collapsed because it was a port city. This road went to the port. It's now about 13 kilometres inland because they cut down all the trees in the surrounding forest and the river silted up and destroyed the city. So things can happen. Babylon collapsed in 140 BC, the great city of the ancient world. So people say, well, you know, we got no show. Well, everything is based on oil. It's going to all collapse. But there is increasing awareness. We've certainly seen that on climate change. Peak oil, it's happening daily. There are people who say that only white swans exist. It is possible to deny it. If so, and if those cities keep saying that, they will go into a very severe decline. So some cities will do better than others. The second option is ruralised city, and some of my colleagues from Australia invented permaculture. And permaculture is a fantastic agricultural system on a small scale. But some people have made it into a philosophy and an urban philosophy, and essentially saying that cities will just become very intensive food production areas and will no longer work as cities. They'll just be essentially medieval villages where we barter and exchange. Even Matthew Simmons, the Houston banker, when asked what should we do, said start growing your own food. I think there needs to be more than that. They often use Havana as the example of the city that responded when the Soviet oil was cut off and now grows 40% of its own food. And often they say the best thing is to scatter urban areas. The suburbs are ideal for permaculture because there's plenty of space and no one will be travelling because it's just rural food production. Now, I do think that localised food production will increase, and Tim talks a lot about this, about food miles and slow food, but cities will remain as cities. The great urban experiment's not going to stop. Cities create opportunities. They are not for just bartering food, and I do think we have to reassert that cities are important. Green urbanism, title that Tim has used, means that cities are more urban and more green. They are cities, though. The third option is divided city. Wealthy eco-enclaves surrounded by Mad Max suburbs. It's worth looking at the Mad Max films again. This is another Australian contribution. George Miller, when he wrote these, was aware of peak oil. And it's pretty scary stuff. But the wealthy eco-enclaves are happening. And it is highly probable that we'll get this very divided city because the wealthy are choosing to live in good locations, with good public transport, where you can walk and bike, lots of healthy food and all of those opportunities. You can buy that now. It's certainly becoming very apparent in Australian cities. But I find it in American cities as well. This is looking from a hotel in Century City, Los Angeles, down on a new development that I thought, this is a new urbanist kind of development. I must go and have a look at this. And you go down and there's an armed guard preventing you from going in. You can buy into these enclaves, of course. All of those responses to me are based on fear. And no policy based on fear ever really works. They are not resilient. So the resilient city is building a new economy in which our cities are more resilient. And there will be a lot of new things that happen. There need to be some black swans pulled out of the hat. And that has happened in the past. This is the city of hope. Now, if you look at the waves of innovation, economic theory does have these understandings, which can be related to innovation, but they also can be related to city form. The first wave of innovation in industrialism, the iron, water, power, mechanisation era, that was based around the old walking cities with water-based transport linking them. And In the 1840s, there was a massive depression, and out of that came the steam power era with railroads that took those cities further out. They followed the trains, and most American cities, Australian cities, were built in that era with the steam trains and steel. In the 1890s, there was a massive depression that ended that era. And out of that came the electric era, where we had tramways, electric light, and we were able to get rid of all the coal boilers and so on and have a much more easy city to live in because you weren't living next to the production of that power. The first cars appeared, but they didn't shape the cities at that point. The cities were built around trams and trains. And in the 1930s, that era ended. Massive depression again. Out of that era came the car-based city with cheap oil, and the cities spread based on that new economy. It's a little harder to tell history when you're close to it, but we've had an era of the digital revolution, which has helped our cities rebuild. A lot of the old industrial areas, like in Vancouver, now been replaced with the new economy based around services and the new digital economy. But the next era, and I think it is going to come out of this collapse that we're in now, is the era of sustainability. Radical resource productivity, massive changes, the factor four, factor 10 kind of economy where we'll have massively less fossil fuel use. Whole system design, biomimicry, green chemistry, renewable energy, and green nanotechnology. These kind of technologies are appearing and will need to be built into the new economy. We can't go back and say that that previous era, based on cheap fuel and cars, freeways, we just have to somehow prop it up. We can't. And in the past, we've had to move on. There is a real tendency in the present environment to say, look, let's just pour money into everything to prop it up, but if we aren't clever about where we use that money, we could actually be making it worse. You go to any American city and they're just amazing, the amount of concrete, the amount of money that has gone into building these freeways. They're just endless. And I think we will look back on them and say, you know, how do we ever do it? This is about the size of a medieval city. It's one freeway interchange.
Green 960 AM in San Francisco and around the world at green960.com. I'm Alex Smith, and this is the Radio EcoShock Show. Welcome to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We'll dive right back into a speech at Simon Fraser University by the Australian city design expert Peter Newman. His book is Resilient Cities, Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change.
When you look at what they do for a city, it's not much. If you try to see how delay is being reduced by building freeways, there's no evidence of it. The Texas Transportation Institute provides all this kind of data. There is no correlation in there between delay and freeway miles. And it's really easy to see why, and essentially to recognise that the freeway is a failed technology. Cities adapt to their one-hour travel time budget. We go into that in a good deal of detail, but no matter what the infrastructure is that's provided, significantly, freeways fail as public spaces. They don't provide for us that urbanity that makes cities work, and in a post-peak oil world, they're dinosaurs. What they do to cities is essentially not good for economies or people. If you look down, this is a freeway only carries 2,500 people down one lane in an hour. A busway 5,000, a light rail 10 to 20,000, and a train 50,000. So it's a factor of 20. So you can see that space that you save, enormous amount of space. That space is money, space is urbanity, space is a good city. And of course we know that land use follows these transport patterns, and urban scatter, as I call it, is now a major issue. There are a lot of human aspects to it as well. This English study was an interesting one. They looked at the difference between kids who got taken to school by car and those who walked or who went by public transport, and they called them battery hen kids or free range kids. The battery hen kids grow up much more fearful. They don't understand their place. They don't trust strangers, and they don't develop the consequent risk-taking abilities. And free range kids, of course, do that much quicker. So there is so many issues that you can look at on that front. The amazing thing is to see things like this happening. This freeway in Seoul covers the main river, which is a sacred river in their history, and was enormously unpopular that the freeway was built, but of course you had to do it. It's the only space left in the city. But 5 years ago, or a little over now, the Consumer Association there put candidates up for the mayoralty, and the one who said he'd take that down won the election. And you imagine him going to the traffic engineers saying, "We got to take that down." But they did it. And the result has been an extraordinary public park, a greening of the city. The traffic has disappeared. They've got some public transport that's replaced it, but mostly it's just disappeared. And it's a model, really, of the way in which a city can cope without those kind of car-based structures. Same thing happened in Aarhus, a small Danish town. The Aarhus River runs underneath that arterial road, so they dug it up and created these wonderful spaces. The mayor of Aarhus goes all over Europe these days because cities say, "We want to try and find a river to dig up." London even has got amazing commitments now to, this is the Millennium Bridge, which was a pedestrian bridge, very symbolic of the new era. And the future city can be actually a better place. It can be a place that is a great deal more freedom, where kids can roam like this and not be scared because of cars or stranger danger. This is a city that is built for people as well as being much more ecologically sensitive. So what do we need? We need imagination. We need the black swans. We need post-oil strategies. We need partnerships and stories about those partnerships, and that's what we've got in our book. And we need hope, and certainly that opportunity now is there. Thanks very much.
That was Peter Newman in Vancouver, January 9th, 2009. Peter is no mere theorist. He's headed up sustainable city design in Australia, made big changes, and is now an advisor for a $20 billion fund for a green rebuild of Australia's infrastructure. You have just heard the kickoff speech for his book tour. The title is Resilient Cities, Responding to Peak Oil and Climate Change, just published by Island Press. The book is not an academic deadweight by any means. It's quite user-friendly and compact. It hits you where you live. You can download this speech and the previous Radio EcoShock on Transport Revolution by Pearl and Gilbert from our website at ecoshock.org. Select Transportation from our Audio On Demand menu. Find out more about Peter Newman and his co-authors at resilientcitiesbook.org. That's resilientcitiesbook.org. Thank you for listening.